Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is writer and novelist J. Robert Lennon. Lennon holds an MFA from the University of Montana and currently teaches writing at Cornell University. His short fiction has appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, The Paris Review, and Playboy. He is the author of 7 novels, including Mailman, Familiar, and Castle. His most recent book is a collection of short stories called See You in Paradise. It was published by Grey Wolf Press in November of this year. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish. Good to be back.
Now you're known mostly as a novelist. So what is the impulse to write short stories for somebody who primarily writes longer fiction?
I'm not sure where it comes from, but I do know that it's a great feeling to get the idea for one and try to execute it fairly quickly. Usually, if I don't manage to finish a draft of a story in a few days, I'll probably never finish it. I do a lot of revision on them afterward often, and that was the case with just about everything in this collection. But most of them, from conception to completion of a draft, was, you know, very little time at all. Whereas a novel obviously takes longer, but it's a pleasure to indulge in the kind of deeper thinking of a novel. But sometimes a short story, at least for me, if you write it fast enough, things come out that you didn't realize were in there.
That's interesting. It's almost like stream of consciousness.
A little bit, yeah.
And I can see why you can't do that with a longer book, which, you know, you have to go back and make sure it makes sense and have details.
Chunks of a novel might come out that way, but ultimately when you get to the end and realize what it was you were actually doing that whole time, you've got to go back and make everything work together, make all the moving parts fit.
Now, this current collection is fascinating to me. So many of the characters seem like normal, everyday Joes, if you will. And then when you go deeper, you find discontentment and strange, bizarre feelings and behaviors. Where did that come from? Did you feel that way about American Life, though, that there's this hidden level?
I think everybody's like that, aren't they? One of the reasons we like to read fiction is because we suspect that everyone is actually peculiar, and we want to dig in there and find out what it is that's peculiar about them. You know, it's a pleasure for me to think about that. And I like to talk to people, too, so I often will winnow out people's secrets. You know, I'll dig them out and get them to confess things to me. And then I'll put it verbatim into novels. No, I don't do that. But I do really enjoy getting to know people deeply and getting to imagine for those people I don't know well what they might really be like.
Yeah. Well, you know, but the thing is, some of the people who do write blurbs for your book and for some of your other books that had somewhat bizarre outcomes and characters, it almost seems like this isn't the way people really are. You know, you're hitting some kind of level that most people maybe keep secret.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we don't want anybody to know the ways in which we're embarrassingly weird and what our desires are and what our flaws are that we're hiding from everyone.
Uh-huh.
But knowing those things is fun for others.
Well, you know what else I find interesting? A lot of your stories have narrators that are really friendly and kind of casual. How much is that based on you?
I think it's based on the surface of me. And I grew up in an amiable family. I would always be impressed when I was a kid going out with my father to the post office or the hardware store. He just had a facility for talking to anybody. He's a very friendly guy.
Uh-huh.
And I wasn't like that when I was a kid and kind of learned to be like that when I became an adult. And it's a kind of facade. I mean it. I mean, I really do like to be friendly and I do enjoy interacting with people. I don't know. But, you know, I've kind of brought that into a lot of the characters in my work. People, you know, in my life, it's kind of a delight. But I think for a lot of people, that's a facade that they're kind of desperately holding on to, you know, or at least the characters I like to imagine are like that.
Uh-huh.
So. You know, the guy in the first story, Portal.
I loved that.
Oh, thanks. I wanted him to be a very conventional person, or at least someone who thinks of himself as a conventional person, who lives in a conventional family, a conventional American family, that then encounters something impossible, which is really sort of a metaphor for the impossibility of knowing, you know, your kids and your spouse and even yourself.
Well, you know what? I was going to bring up Portal anyway, because to me it felt almost like you were reaching into the psychological side of these people that didn't really come out in their real lives, but comes out via this strange thing that happens. I don't know how much you want to give away on that story, but...
Well, I think it's right on the first page, but these people buy a house out on the edge of town, and they find a broken magic portal out in the backyard, and the universe of the story, rhetorically, the story treats it like any other old house element, like a barn,
yeah,
you know, or an attic. In this world, a lot of houses have a portal out back, and it's just a thing maybe people used to have more often, but it's a bit old-fashioned now, and this one's on the fritz, and the family ends up fooling around with it, and they go through it and end up having disturbing adventures that ultimately come to, first very subtly, but then quite nakedly reflect what their own fears and desires
Yeah,
are.
That's why I thought this was the most psychological one in there.
That's interesting.
To me it felt Freudian almost.
Yeah.
These people were discovering what they really felt by going through this portal instead of being able to act it out in their real lives. It was really interesting.
The portal has a kind of intelligence and it tries to give them stuff. It tries to give them what it thinks they want by reading their thoughts.
Yeah.
You know? But, of course, it doesn't realize that we don't actually want what we want.
Exactly.
You know, where the things that we desire are often things that are dangerous. But there's a reason we haven't gone out and gotten them, you know?
Yeah.
But the portal doesn't know that.
Now, do these individual stories come to you? Like, does a character come to you and then you write the story? How does it happen? One line or what?
In this case, it was a voice. You know, I've used similar voices in the past of a guy who's kind of proudly and stridently ordinary, you know, who is in denial about the fact that no one is ordinary. But, he's trying to do things by the book and that, you know, is in fear of having to recognize that it turns out there never was a book for things to go by. But in this case, I had the voice and I thought it would be fun to do essentially a science fiction story as a piece of middle class domestic drama.
Yeah, yeah. It's the one that affected me the most. I absolutely loved it. I also was really affected by the story Hibachi.
Oh, yeah.
Which was, you know, it seemed to me that a telltale story about domestic life in many ways and how stifling it is. And so talk to us about it.
Yeah, that came from an Ithaca news item from years ago that you might remember this. There was a woman who was just crossing a street at a marked intersection and dropped some papers and then just sort of crouched down to pick them up. And a guy hit her in an SUV and she died, unfortunately, and she was dragged several blocks.
I remember the story.
He never even noticed. The cops caught up to him at Home Depot or something. You know?
Right, I remember the story.
It just was so tragic. And I wanted this guy in the story, of course, the protagonist who's hit by the car survives. And I wanted him to be utterly humiliated and debased, but he's the kind of guy who just sort of goes on with things. So he's confined to a wheelchair, and he has a wife who is of a very nervous nature. They love each other very much, but they, you know, because of his injuries, they can't have sex anymore. Uh-huh. And she feels stifled, but she loves him so much that she can't express that in any conventional way. So she buys him a big... hibachi grill. I was thinking of the ones at Kyushu, the restaurant that used to be up by Applebee's. Where they perform in front of you. They flip the ingredients around. And they flip the knives up, you know, in the air, and then they like yeah. pretend to throw food at you and catch it at the last minute. But she ends up, you know, she ends up going rogue. She ends up having to the emotions she can't express. To him, she ends up expressing through this hibachi.
And she takes it out on other people besides
who people she thinks have wronged her husband.
I thought that was a really interesting story. See, I mean, that's why all these seem very psychological to me. Mm-hmm. People acting out things in these stories that they can't really in real life.
Yeah.
And so if this is your vision of what people really are like, John, I'm afraid for your friends.
Oh, come on.
In many ways.
You know it. You know people are really like this.
Which story in this collection is your favorite? I know this was compiled over 15 years of work, but to tell us.
I can't say that I have a favorite. Although that one, the one we just talked about, is kind of dear to me. I guess the one I enjoy reading most, when I was on tour, I would try to read a different one every night. And the one I enjoy reading most is probably Zombie Dan.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a comedy.
A lot of them are funny.
Yeah,
in a dark way.
A friend of mine was interviewing me for a literary magazine called Gigantic was having a humor issue, and a friend of mine wrote an interview with me in which we talked about humor. I hadn't really thought of this as comic fiction.
Mm.
I think if you put yourself out there as a comic writer, you're kind of asking for abuse. It's a really hard thing to do consistently well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so I think of it as corollary aspect to what I'm actually trying to do.
Yeah.
But maybe I am just trying to be funny. Maybe that's my
shit. Some of it's really dark humor. I mean, I laughed out loud a couple times, mainly because one identifies with some of these sentiments that come out of these people's mouths. But people don't usually say it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that's where the humor came. It's a dark humor. It's not like funny books or something, you know.
Yeah.
That's what I loved about it.
I'll take that.
To tell us more about Zombie Dan.
Oh, it's another sort of familiar version of the world with one small difference in it. And in this case, it's that science has figured out a way to bring people back to life. If they have died in non-traumatic ways and they have a lot of money to do the procedure, they can be brought back to life. But when they come back to life, they're different. And the unpolitically correct word that people use to refer to them as zombies. They're not canonical zombies like the brain-eating monsters of movies. And one of the ways that these restored life individuals, as the preferred term, one of the ways that they sort of come back is they're supposed to have people from their past surrounding them for the first month when they're back, like sharing memories so that they can, you know, recover what has been lost during the time they were dead. But eventually, as this guy, Dan Larson is his name, he comes back to life, and his old friends, who actually didn't like him very much, are helping to bring him back.
I love that part.
Under the direction of his wealthy and very angry
and snobby mother.
She's a bit of a snob, yeah. Ultimately, they realize that now that he's come back to life, he can read minds. And everyone is very surprised and disturbed by this. So.
And then you also talk about whether somebody has a soul in part of the book.
Yeah,
I mean, in part
of
that story.
Yeah, there's a riff in there about, like, if you can bring someone back to life, then what is the soul? And there's contrasting arguments, one saying that because of this, it proves the existence of God, and another argument says that it disproves the existence of God. So,
yeah. So you leave the question open, right?
What, I'm not going to solve that one.
Yeah.
I hereby and forever leave that question open.
Do you see through these stories that, I mean, a big discontentment in our culture right now? Because these stories seem so modern about today's culture, you know? I mean, there's a lot of high-tech stuff in some of them, and, you know, it feels like it's more so now, discontentment now.
I don't know. I don't know if I want to get on board with that. I mean, I tend to feel like it's always been that way, that everyone can identify a vein of discontent in their culture because I think it's human nature, you know? I mean, I consider myself to be very happy, generally speaking, but the truth is, I'm discontent all the time, Nothing is ever perfect. I always want to tweak something, which is also a condition of being a writer, too. But that part of our culture, which I agree definitely exists, is something that I have great fun teasing out in my fiction.
Yeah, and I think you could probably only write it if you were as a happy person in some ways. I mean, because who wants to go down into the depths if you really are somebody who can't come out of there?
There's a lot of romance to the notion that if, you know, a writer is a depressed alcoholic and who's been wounded by his ability to see things clearly. But, you know, I've been down in the dumps, and I've known a lot of very depressed friends, and they do not have a very good time trying to work. You know, I think happiness plus skepticism is probably a good recipe for getting some creative work done.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer J. Robert Lennon. We're talking about his new collection of short stories called See You in Paradise. I love that title. It's so perfect.
Oh, thanks.
Because we're not in paradise, right?
Yeah.
It almost seems like a sarcastic title.
I argued for different titles for the book, and my publisher, everyone at Grey Wolf wanted it to be See You in Paradise, and I argued against it, and I just gave up, and of course now I think they were right. I think it's probably a good title for the collection.
Why did you not want it?
It felt too familiar to me. Like, I thought there were too many other books with...
Like Scott Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise.
Yeah, that's true. There were a lot of titles that kind of evoked a similar rhetorical feel. But actually, that's not a disadvantage. It's probably an advantage, actually.
Yeah.
I wanted a weirder, more enigmatic title, but I think that when someone is looking at books, they're more intrigued by something that suggests things more directly.
And also, this title will bring people in, and they'll be very surprised when they read the stories, because it's the opposite of, you know, yeah.
Well,
of what they would think.
Well, the story that comes from is the notion of, you know, it's about a guy who ends up getting a job in what is supposed to be a paradisical tropical island, and it's actually for him it turns out to be a kind of hell.
Yeah, that was an interesting story too. Now, I want to talk a story of yours that's not in this collection called The Rememberer that was turned into a CBS. What was it called? It was called Unforgettable.
Unforgettable, yeah.
Tell us what you felt about watching your story be translated for what we would call probably Hollywood.
It was fun. I mean, I didn't. They only used about a paragraph of the story.
Really?
Yeah. The story was about a woman who, and I ripped off the idea from Borges. It was a character, a woman who's afflicted with with never being able to forget anything.
Mm-hmm.
She has total recall. And I later found out that this is a real thing and that some people are able to actually have total recall in real life, which I didn't know. But,
yeah.
But I had her go through from childhood until death, going through all the various things that she could do with her life, having this talent / curse. And one of them was being a police detective. And that was what the TV series was. A woman who can't forget anything is a police detective. And so I didn't write any of the episodes. The first episode has elements from my story in it, but for the most part, it all came from the writers and producers of the series, who I met were just wonderful people.
But were you disappointed that they didn't use more of the flavor of your work?
No, it's a different thing. I mean, the flavor of my work is in my work, and they were welcome to do whatever they wanted with the idea. And I think that it's, you know, if what they wanted to make was a sort of freaky cop drama, they did a great job of it. And I watched the show. I really enjoyed it. And the actors were terrific. And the show was quite funny, actually, as well as, you know, intriguing. And I got to go to the set and meet everybody.
Yeah. Because I know a lot of writers who don't like the way their work is translated. So I wondered what you felt about that.
I really couldn't care less. I mean, I'm trying to do a little bit of screenwriting. You know, what I mostly do is write short stories and novels. And if you want to make it into a good movie, you're going to have to write it as a movie, you know? And what is good for a piece of written fiction is not necessarily good for a film or a television series. So I actually think it's interesting to see. And when I've collaborated with people on creative projects, it's always fun for me to see what other directions, what people see in my work that they could grab and run with in a different way.
Yeah.
And because I already did my part.
That's an interesting observation, huh? Interesting way of looking at it. Speaking of observation, you are obviously a good observer of people's behaviors and characters and stuff. Do you keep a journal? Do you keep notes? You say you talk to people a lot, and it does come out in your books.
You know, I didn't used to take a lot of notes, which seems really strange to me. And I actually, this year I decided that I would get into notebooks, and I would carry notebooks. And, you know, because I'm kind of a nerd, I immediately went on this sort of, I have like a zillion fountain pens and weird Japanese pencils.
Yeah, to find the perfect notebook.
Stuff. Yeah. So now I have one notebook that I actually do creative writing in. Like I do my writing in it, or some of my writing anyway. Then I have another notebook for notes. And
so you're keeping notes.
So I'm keeping notes more than I used to. Mostly I just depend on retaining things and then making things up. I sometimes feel like actual information is a burden, and that I kind of like taking a small idea and letting it be the seed from which something imaginative will come.
Uh-huh.
And so it's more of a pleasure to me. It's not a pleasure to me to go into my notebook and take a bunch of research that I've done and translate it into fiction.
Oh, I understand that.
I just like making stuff up. It's the reason I do this. So mostly these days, the purpose of taking notes is to remember it. Like, I'm not looking at the notes later. I'm just sort of, by writing them down, I'm kind of
burning them,
you know.
Yeah.
Pushing them further down into my mind so that they can be part of the part of the stew, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting, because so many of the poets I talk to say, I've got to write it down immediately, or it's lost, mm-hmm. you know, the lines that come to people.
Now, yeah, you know, that's true, but I also feel like I sometimes regret it when I get a good idea or, you know, if I'm doing music and I think of a song lyric or something and I don't write it down and then it goes away.
Yeah.
There'll be another one will come along. I mean, I feel like there's something when I meet people for the first time who find out that I'm a writer, they often ask me about ideas. Like they ask me where I get my ideas or I have an idea. I've actually gotten people, you know, writing to me and saying, I have an idea for a novel. Like, I'll give you the idea, you write the novel, and
we'll
split the proceeds, you know.
That is great.
What it comes down to is just ideas are nothing. Like, I think any artist gets a zillion ideas a day, any one of which could be turned into something good, but it's the process of doing it that makes it into something good, not the process of getting the idea.
Ah.
It's not like, I mean, certainly some ideas have proven more fruitful than others for me, and that's probably the case for everybody, but I don't really worry about losing an idea. There's always plenty of those.
Yeah, well, it sounds like there is from you. Obviously, you come up with ideas constantly. Mm-hmm. These stories, like I said, were compiled from 15 years of your writing. Did you find yourself having to rewrite anything? Did you change anything in the early stories?
I thought maybe I would have to, but... And there are definitely things where they weren't wince-inducing, actually, but I did see the younger me coming through very clearly.
Really?
And they're not, you know, some of them I would not have written it that way now. But in the end, I kind of like the idea of honoring the person that I was when I was 28. And I wrote I think that's when I wrote this story, Flight, I might have been, 26. It was almost 20 years ago now. And I kind of see through that story in a way now that I couldn't have when I was younger. But at the same time, the particular notions of a 26-year-old me were, if not super compelling to me now, were probably worth. I thought it was a good enough story in and of itself to make it worth preserving in the book.
Yeah, I would think so too. You can watch your evolution too, but I think all the stories in this work.
Oh, thanks.
Think you probably picked the best of all of them. I want to bring up this fact that Alice Munro, in an interview that I heard, said that she thought short stories when she first started her career were just going to be practice, and she thought for sure she'd be writing novels, but she found she could only write short stories. Did you feel that way about short stories at all? I mean, she obviously has come around, but...
No, but I came of age reading Alice Munro, so...
Yeah.
You know, she was one of the first... you know, I had only read, like, science fiction, really, before, and fantasy...
Really?
I discovered the great short story writers of the 80s, you know, Anne Beattie and Raymond Carver and Alice Munro, Donald Barthelme. And they, in my 20s, were, you know, incredibly important to me. But Alice Munro, like Chekhov in the, you know, a century before, was one of those writers who... just sort of remind us how deep the possibilities of the form are. And all of those writers in their way, you know, especially the minimalists who had a style that was sort of trending at the time, they gave us a way of seeing the form that was exciting and that showed possibilities that maybe we had forgotten about. So for me, the short story was a goal in and of itself. I was a little bit afraid of the novel until I was finishing graduate school. Well, no, I actually tried to write a novel at the beginning of graduate school, and it was not very good. Oh. But then I got it together and wrote one that I could actually publish. And now I mostly think of myself as a novelist, but I love short stories.
Yeah, I think of you as a novelist too. Yeah, but you love short stories. You know, I have had to come around to the genre because I always feel like I'm wanting more from a short story, especially if it's really compelling to me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they end abruptly by the very virtue of the fact that they're supposed to be short stories. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible to have a taste or not taste for the form. That book of 100 stories of mine, the 100 really short stories, my mother's reaction to it was, I wish they were longer. But of course, the whole point is they're supposed to leave you wanting. You know?
Yeah,
they're supposed to plant enough ideas in your head and then give you just enough to make you have to do the work of creating them yourself almost, which is a quality of literature in general, that, you know, it's a participatory medium. It's a thing. You have to bring something to it. You can't sort of check out and let it wash over you.
Yeah. And good short stories make you think and stay with you.
Yeah.
In many ways.
And I like an enigmatic story, too, one that I don't quite get. That's an experience I like. If that happens in a novel and I've invested 3-4 days of reading into it and I don't know what the hell I just read, I'm frustrated. But a short story, I like to be left with that flavor of something, of having missed something, you know. I like the idea that the stage of the story is very small and there's all around it, there's things going on that you can't quite see.
Almost like a play, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how interesting. How important are editors, to especially to you as a writer?
Very important.
Yeah?
Because I don't know if what I've done is any good or not.
Really?
No. I think, if I might love it because I'm a narcissist who is proud of my own creations, but, you know, I don't actually know if it's, and I think whether something is good or not, we probably define that on whether or not other people can find something in it to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually give, my wife is my first reader for most stuff, and I have several friends who are also really good critics, and mm-hmm. They always read my first drafts and give me ideas, and then I plow some of those ideas into the next draft and rip some stuff out and put some stuff in. In case of novels, maybe the third draft goes to my literary agent and I might do another draft based on his comments, and then maybe draft 4 will go to my book editor, and if the publisher agrees to publish it, then I'll go through 4 or 5 more.
God, that's amazing. It's amazing work. People don't realize. You know,
when
you see the final product, you think, oh, beautiful. But there's so much work, hard.
And it's not just crossing the T's and dotting the I's.
Exactly. It's architecture. I mean, it really is the building of it, and with many other people involved. Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Tell us what you're working on now. Another novel?
Yeah, I'm writing a novel about the germ of the idea is based on something my wife and I did, which was we moved here and bought a house that someone had been murdered in. And it was quite inexpensive.
My goodness,
as a result.
I'll bet.
Yeah. And in this, the novel I'm writing, the couple in question has a troubled marriage, and they have a precocious 12-year-old daughter, and they move upstate from New York City and they buy a house that this crime has been committed in. It's an unsolved murder, and the sort of ghosts of the past end up coming back to haunt them. Not only the past of the house, but their own lives, the problems of their own lives.
Wow. Well, we will look forward to that. Can you give some contact information so people can get in touch? Or
sure. JRobertLennon.com is my website, and I run a little literary blog there called Litter Ambivalence that there's a link to. And I'm at J. Robert Lennon on Twitter, where I spend a little time every day.
Uh-huh.
So if anyone wants to ask me questions about things, do it on Twitter.
Great. Well, J. Robert Lennon, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called A See You in Paradise, a wonderful collection of short stories. Go out and get it. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.